Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for October's Nurses Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, Senior Veterinary Nurse at Anderson Moores Veterinary Specialists, Denise Prisk. Thank you, Denise. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Ema. Hello and welcome, everyone. We're going to talk this afternoon on anaesthesia for patients with endocrine disease. Well, the endocrine system is largely concerned with regulating normal homeostasis, and it's closely linked with the hypothalamus of the brain, which is the control centre, if you like, or the HQ. So any imbalance is going to have an impact on anaesthesia. Regulation of the stress response is a prime function, and endocrine diseases can have a negative effect on the normal mechanisms, and so that increases the anaesthetic risk for the patient. Now, anaesthesia might be needed for primary disease reasons, so an example of that would be a thyroidectomy in a cat, or anaesthesia may be needed because of a non-related reason, and it also may be planned or emergency. And hopefully the patient will be stabilised if the procedure is planned, but others may not be, and that again will increase the risk. Now, endocrine diseases would be a huge subject, a huge topic to cover, because there are many endocrine diseases that affect our veterinary patients. So I'm just going to focus on four, and we're going to do a bit of a whirlwind tour of the four common endocrine diseases that we might see in practice. So we're going to be looking at feline hypothyroidism, and then the two adrenal gland diseases, Cushing's and Addison's, and then finish up with diabetes mellitus. So starting off with feline hypothyroidism, this is a condition which has been around for many, many years. It was first recognised and treated back in the 1970s, so over 40 years. And the way in which we approach and manage and treat hypothyroidism has changed hugely over those years. It tends to be common in older cats, and because of the age, then there may be other conditions that we might need to be aware of. And we do need to consider the impact of both of the thyroid hormones on the various organ systems. So we've got T3 as well as T4. T3 is triiodothyronin and T4 is thyroxin. So we need to think, how will they impact the various organ systems, and how is that going to have any knock-on effects on anaesthesia? And the hypermetabolic state of these patients presents us with many anaesthesia-related problems. So to look at the effects of hypothyroidism on the body, well, it affects body condition, as these animals are often thin and they've lost muscle mass, and this loss of muscle mass affects drug metabolism and will also get reduced redistribution of drugs because of the lack of fat. The fact that they have an increased metabolic rate means that they've got higher oxygen requirements than normal. And also, T3 and T4 have a direct action on the heart. So these thyroid hormones directly affect heart rate and inotropy, causing an increase in both. Inotropy is the force of contractions. So as well as making the heart beat faster, they also make it beat more strongly. So in people, we describe these increased force of contractions as palpitations. And we will get tachyarrhythmias, so the heart goes fast, and we also have arrhythmias. And these animals tend to have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and this is secondary to thyroid disease. They're hypertensive, and that's important for us to remember, because we need to try and match the blood pressure that they're used to under general anaesthesia. And the hemodynamic changes, one of the most common ones that we see is that they have bounding pulses. So when you do your physical examination, you'll get these bounding pulses. And the fact that they have this tachycardia and tachyarrhythmias means that there is less relaxation time for the heart to fill. So because there's less time, we get a faster ventricular filling, and that again will give us arrhythmias. The fact that they've got increased blood flow to the organs, particularly the kidneys, often means that they can manage a renal failure that maybe they wouldn't be able to if they weren't hyperthyroid. And sadly, sometimes when we address the thyroid issues, we unmask this renal failure because we bring the blood flow back to within normal parameters, and therefore the kidneys can often suffer as a consequence. And temperature changes in hyperthyroidism, often they're quite hot when they're awake because of the increased metabolic rate. But when they're anaesthetized, they become hypothermic because of the lack of fat and vasodilation from drugs. But also, there's vasodilation from T3. So that causes relaxation of the vascular smooth muscle and leads to vasodilation and further heat loss. So that's another way in which thyroid hormones can affect what happens to the body under anaesthesia. We may run into ventilation complications. If they have a goiter, which is a large mass in the airway, that will press on the airway, and that can lead to a difficult intubation. So we need to be thoroughly prepared for that. And also, weak respiratory muscles mean that they may not breathe very well. So you can see here in this picture, this is a thyroid tumor, but you can see here it's quite a big tumor. That's in the airway of a smallish cat or a normal-sized cat. That's going to create a lot of pressure and give us some issues. Thyroid storm. Well, thyroid storm is rare. That's the first thing I need to say about that. But if it happens, it's an intense release, a sudden and massive release of T3 and T4. And then that leads to the release of catecholamines. Catecholamines are the stress hormones. So we're looking here at adrenaline and noradrenaline. And when catecholamines are released, we will get an increase in heart rate and blood pressure, and also a massive increase in oxygen requirements, which are already high. And additionally, there's an increase in temperature as well. It's usually seen in undiagnosed, untreated patients, and they are normally human patients. But anaesthesia and surgery can also cause thyroid storm. So this is a, you might hear it being referred to as a thyrotoxic crisis, but it is rare in veterinary patients. And stress, obviously, these thyroid cats are usually quite stressy. And so, as well as being stressed by things when they're awake, they also get stressed when they're anaesthetized. We can have surgical stress, and manipulation of the thyroid gland in itself may cause a thyroid storm. So one thing that features quite predominantly throughout this presentation is looking at preoperative stabilization, emphasizing how important it is that these animals are stable before we anaesthetize them. So pre-op bloods need to be done, particularly looking at your hydration status, so your PCV and total solids or total protein. Kidney enzymes, yes, because they may be raised. And also liver enzymes might be raised because of the toxic effects of thyroid hormones on the liver, and also to see what our electrolytes are. It's thought that up to 30% of cats with hyperthyroidism may be azotemic as well. So we need to listen to the heart and the lungs. You might hear heart murmurs, and you may hear a gallop rhythm. A gallop rhythm is where you hear three or four heart sounds instead of the normal two. And that's seen, well, it's seen in many conditions, but also in particularly in fast ventricular filling. We need to know what is the resting heart rate, because the aim under general anaesthesia is to keep the heart rate similar to what the animal is used to in order to maintain cardiac output. Now, I've put here pre-op ECG and blood pressure if possible. It may well not be possible because these patients are quite angry and stressy. Maybe they're not going to let you hook them up to an ECG or even take their blood pressure. But if you can get these parameters before we anaesthetize them, then it does give us something else to go on. Arrhythmias may occur because of catecholamine release or because of hypoxia, and obviously their blood pressure might be high. So if we know what their baseline parameters are, that will help when they're anaesthetized. So handling is often difficult if they are stressy and angry. And so we need to be careful when we're doing things with sharp objects. So if you're taking blood or placing catheters, just be careful, take time and use Emla cream if necessary. So here we've got a naughty torty, so she's probably going to be naughty even if she wasn't hypothyroid. In order to decrease the anaesthetic risk, patients should be euthyroid before they're anaesthetized. Euthyroid just means they should have normal circulating thyroid hormone levels. So we do need to get those thyroid function tests done fairly close to the time of anaesthesia. And thyroid medication will be given on the morning of surgery or the morning of anaesthesia. So I'm not really going to discuss drugs really at all during this presentation, but we do need to consider what the drugs, what the effects are going to be, you know, how the drug is going to affect the body, how the body is going to affect the drug, because the responses to drugs that we give might not be as we would normally predict. They need to be adequately hydrated before anaesthesia, and if they have already got heart disease present, then we need to be careful that we don't increase preload. Preload relates to the amount of blood that's left in the left ventricle at the end of diastole. And in HCM cases, the left ventricular wall is thickened, so the chamber size is going to be smaller. In other words, there's going to be less blood volume available in the left ventricle. And also, there's poor relaxation between contractions. So pre-oxygenation is nearly always a good idea because it maximises the oxygenation of tissues and it helps prevent hypoxemia at induction because desaturation may occur. So pre-oxygenation, a little bit of a misnomer really, because it should be before induction of anaesthesia and it should also continue during induction. These patients have got high oxygen demand, so that's another reason to sort of load them up with oxygen before anaesthetising them. But it must be stress-free. So here we've got a cat, this is Marcus, in the incubator, and we're piping oxygen into that incubator. He was actually not a stress, he doesn't look particularly stress-free here, but that's probably because I'm pointing a camera at him. But advantages to doing it in something like an incubator is that you can leave the cat alone. It's a completely hands-off approach. The disadvantage, of course, is that as soon as you open the door, you've lost that concentration. So the aim of pre-oxygenating is to increase the fraction of oxygen that they breathe in from what it is in atmospheric air, which is a little under 21%, to something that's a bit higher. So if you use a tight-fitting mask, you can probably get your fraction of inspired oxygen up to about 60%. But obviously, with a cat that's stressed and maybe angry, the chances of being able to pop a tight-fitting mask on are fairly slim. If we just use flow-by, then we might only increase it to 25 or maybe 30%. Intubation, it might be difficult. I mentioned before that if they've got a big goiter, a big mass, then being able to pass an ET tube won't be as easy as you would expect. So the trachea is often obstructed and we've got a narrow constriction. So make sure that you're properly ready for this. Get several sizes of ET tubes and a laryngoscope, a good laryngoscope with a light source that works. Worst case scenario is if you've got a really big mass in the airway, it might be that the only thing that you can pass into the trachea is a urine catheter. So if you need to do that, then you would need to do that very carefully, pop your catheter into the trachea, and then thread your ET tube over the catheter, then remove the catheter. So you're just using the catheter really as a stylet almost. I've only actually seen that happen maybe twice in many, many years, and that's for cats with really big goiters. We need to make sure that analgesia is maintained in the whole sort of periop period to minimize surgical stress, because that would mean that we have catecholamines released, so those stress hormones would be released, which would not lead to a smooth anesthetic period. Just want to talk about whether or not there is an increased MAC of the inhalant agent. So MAC is the minimum alveolar concentration. So we're looking here at the potency, and it relates to the inhalant agents, all of them, but only isoflurane, sufluorine are the ones that we use. It doesn't relate to the injectable agents. Now, because of the hypermetabolic state, it's always thought that the potency actually decreased, so we would need more inhalant agent to keep them asleep. But study in humans and more recent research study in dogs has shown that that's actually a misunderstanding of the increased volume requirements, which are secondary to a high metabolic rate, but the actual partial pressure of the gas itself is the same. What I'm trying to say really is the potency of isoflurane or sevoflurane is not less, it's just that maybe your volume requirements may be more. So here's a picture of a cat with goiter. This is a sort of classic swelling, or several swellings in the neck of this cat. I'd like to thank Dr. Sarah Caney from Vet Professionals and Cat Professionals for letting me use this photograph. You can see here there's a big goiter which is just sort of out of shot, and there's another one here in the middle, and then there's another one here on the right side of the cat. So this cat has got bilateral thyroid disease, and so we've got several potentially difficult things to do with intubation that might occur. Once we've secured the airway, obviously we're okay, but it might be that you can only get a smaller ET tube in the trachea than you would think likely. And then we need to think of positioning considerations. Obviously, the position of the cat, depending on what we're doing, and here we're doing thyroidectomy, needs to be such that it suits the surgeon, but it also needs to be a position that's safe for the patient. So there are several things that are wrong with this position of this patient. So again, this is Marcus, the same cat that was in the incubator. And you can see his head is and neck are supported with a sandbag. And that's fine, but he should really be, his head and neck should be level with the rest of his body. At the moment, he's in a bit of a head down position, which is not great for him being able to breathe, because head down will impair respiration, and potentially it can decrease the functional residual capacity, the amount of gas that's left in the lungs at the end of expiration. The other things that are wrong with him is he's in a trough. Really try and avoid using troughs to maintain dorsal recumbency, because he's quite a big cat, and you can't see so well because he's covered with bubble wrap, which is going to be under the drapes, but he's sitting a bit proud in that trough, and that means that his chest can't expand, so his chest wall compliance, the elasticity of his chest, is compromised. We can keep them in dorsal recumbency nowadays with other aids. You could use sandbags, or you could use a vacuum support where you just create a vacuum and pop them in the middle, or you could just use a bean bag. So we don't really need to use troughs so much. And also ties are a bit of a no-no as well. The fact that he's in dorsal recumbency in a trough with his head lowered and his legs are tied caudally, that all means that actually he can't breathe very well. So try and leave those hind limbs in a natural position, and try and avoid the use of ties. So we need to monitor all the usual parameters, but things which might be different are temperature. You may get a varied response. We might get an increase in temperature because of the variable metabolic rate. That's likely to happen at the beginning of anaesthesia, straight after induction, but depending how long it goes on for, then the temperature may drop. Heart rate and rhythm, we want to try and keep the heart rate similar to the resting rate, because that is the rate at which the patient operates. With ECG, we need to be looking for arrhythmias. Now, catecholamines And or myocardial hypoxia can cause arrhythmias. So we might see things like atrial fibrillation, which I think is on the next slide, or supraventricular rhythm, supraventricular tachycardia. We want to keep the blood pressure slightly higher than normal if they're hypertensive when awake. So you'd be looking at a mean arterial pressure of 70 to 80 millimeters of mercury. And pulse oximetry, obviously, will assess the oxygen saturation of hemoglobin. So here we've got atrial fibrillation. So we just have these F waves. There are no P waves. Where you'd normally have your P wave here, we've just got a whole series of F waves, sorry, F for fibrillation. It's a supraventricular rhythm, so the QRS and T complexes will look normal. Capnography is really useful. We're likely to see high CO2 because of the increased metabolic rate and the increased oxygen consumption. So CO2 removal must be adequate. You might need to increase your fresh gas flow requirements, and we'll also get hypercapnia because of hypoventilation if they have weak respiratory muscles. It may well be that you need to IPPV these patients with a suitable circuit, or if you've got the luxury of it, pop them on a ventilator. The other thing to keep an eye on is their blood glucose. Glucose as energy is broken down to CO2 and H2O, so carbon dioxide and water. And you may need to give them extra glucose, especially if you're going to be doing a long op. Sometimes thyroid tumours can be very vascular, so keep an eye on intraoperative hemorrhage. It's usually quite a small surgical field, but you can see here that this one is bleeding quite a lot. It's being mopped up with cotton buds rather than swabs. But again, if you're getting through a lot of cotton buds or a lot of swabs, just, make sure that blood loss isn't too excessive, or if it is, you need to do something about it. In the recovery period, oxygen requirements are still going to be high, so supplemental oxygen is probably going to be needed. Also, they need analgesia. Feed them when they're conscious. They go to sleep grumpy. They wake up grumpy. These hypothyroid cats are going to be hungry because of the hypermetabolic state, as well as the fact that they've been starved before anaesthesia. Keep an eye on their temperature and their blood pressure if you can. But what is important, if you have blood gas analysis, is to measure ionized calcium. So the serum ionized calcium. This is the biologically active part of calcium, and that's what's important that we monitor. And do a seizure watch on these patients as well. Seizures can result from hypocalcemia, especially if they've had a bilateral thyroidectomy. So get an intervention plan agreed and drawn up in advance of anaesthesia. And then if you're left alone during the recovery period or there's minimal staff, you know what you can do. It's already been agreed with by your veterinary surgeon. You can just get on and treat these patients without any time delay. The other thing to monitor for is swelling, because that might give you an airway obstruction. So moving on to the adrenal gland diseases. The hypothalamus and the pituitary gland are both involved in the adrenal hormones, and normal homeostasis with regard to adrenal hormones involves both of those. We're going to look at an axis in a minute and see how they're all connected. Fluid and electrolyte balance and cortisol and the stress response are the major considerations when we're looking at patients with adrenal gland disease. And any condition that alters cortisol production can affect the mechanism of the stress response. And this is going to be significant in anaesthetized patients because the body may not be able to respond normally. So this shows the relationship between the brain and the adrenal gland. So the hypothalamus, just grab my arrow, the hypothalamus, which is here, this secretes cortisol-releasing hormone, CRH, And that activates the anterior pituitary gland and makes it secrete adrenocorticotropic hormone. And this in turn acts on the adrenal cortex, which produces cortisol. So all of this little scenario here is called the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. So a very basic recap on adrenal gland physiology. Starting over here, we've obviously got the adrenal glands are split into the medulla and the cortex. If we look at the medulla first, the medulla secretes what we used to call adrenaline and noradrenaline, now tends to be known by the names epinephrine and norepinephrine. So if you've dealt with or heard about patients with a pheochromocytoma, that's a tumour of the medulla, and that's when the tumour makes us secrete more adrenaline, not noradrenaline. But the ones that we're mostly concerned with are over here in with the cortex, and the cortex secretes the sex hormones and the steroids. And the steroids are cortisol. Cortisol is the main glucocorticoid in dogs, cats, and people. Corticosterone, which is also mostly a glucocorticoid, and then aldosterone, which is a mineralocorticoid. And then of those corticosteroids, then we've got over here, really, we're only concerned, the only mineralocorticoid we're concerned with is aldosterone, and aldosterone is concerned with fluid and electrolyte balance. And cortisol is concerned with the stress response. So it does all of these things here. It's concerned with the metabolism of proteins, fats, carbohydrates, glucose metabolism. It has immune effects and anti-inflammatory, it affects the immune system and anti-inflammatory effects, lots of other things as well. So we're starting off with Cushing's disease. Cushing's disease, we can often recognize on patients because they have this sort of classic pot belly and they've got hair loss. So this is a patient here, the dachshund is a classic Cushing's patient. The little kitten, which is his bedfellow, is looking quite horrified at the fact that we've got a bedfellow with pot belly and no hair. So Cushing's disease is due to excess cortisol, the glucocorticoid. It can be primary, where there's a tumour of the adrenal gland, we get adrenal adenoma or adrenal carcinoma, but more often than not, it's secondary. So the tumour is of the pituitary gland, so that means we have increased ACTH because of the pituitary adenoma, and that causes the increase in cortisol. It's thought that of animals that have Cushing's, 85% of them, or as many as 85%, are secondary pituitary dependent. It's seen in older, predominantly female dogs. It's rare in cats, but it may be seen, especially if it's associated with cats that have diabetes mellitus. And because it's seen in older animals, we need to be aware of geriatric-related considerations. So cortisol has got many effects. I've listed some of them over the next few slides, but fat is redistributed, so we get enlarged organs, especially the liver, and you get that big swinging pendulous belly. There's increased production of some of the clotting factors, so hypercoagulation and the risk of pulmonary thromboembolism is quite a serious consideration. There's increased activation of the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, so the animals tend to be hypertensive and there's an increased response to catecholamines and they have renal insufficiency. We also get hepatic gluconeogenesis, which causes a hyperglycemia. Gluconeogenesis literally means making new glucose. It's not made from glycogen, it uses other carbon sources. So it's the synthesis of glucose from non-carbohydrate, non-sugar sources. It's part of the stress response and why we get high blood glucose levels. We also get polycythemia. This is an increased hematocrit, muscle weakness, including the respiratory muscles. And the fact that they've got muscle weakness They're often obese, they've got that large abdomen, means that there's reduced functional residual capacity. And this is made worse when we tip them up into dorsal recumbency. And hypercapnia, the high end tidal CO2 that we've seen, together with the hypoventilation, can lead us on to a respiratory acidosis. Cortisol also means that we might see alveolar collapse with hypoxemia, and that will lead to ventilation perfusion mismatch. And one of the classic effects of cortisol that everyone's familiar with is delayed wound healing, and a higher risk of infection. And these patients tend to have thin skin, which is prone to bruising and tearing, and they also have hair loss. So again, pre-op bloods, hematology and biochemistry, things that you might see are raised liver enzymes, a raised glucose, and also high cholesterol. With your hematology, you will see high hematocrit because of the polycythemia. And also you might see what's known as a stress leukogram. A stress leukogram is where we get high neutrophils and monocytes, but low lymphocytes. And it's seen in many conditions, but it's also seen when cortisol levels are high. With urinalysis, we tend to get dilute urine in dogs, but cats maintain the ability to concentrate urine unless they're in renal failure. If you can get a pre-op blood pressure measurement, that's great because if they are hypertensive when they're awake, it means we need to keep the mean arterial pressure higher under anaesthesia to avoid compromising renal perfusion. And if they're PUPD, then if they're losing a lot of urine, we need to replace the fluid, so make sure the fluid therapy is adequate. So again, we need to be careful when we're inserting needles and catheters, especially if they're nervous patients. Use Emla cream if you've got time, if not something like Ethicalm, the cold spray that's in the picture here, that's really good for producing a local freezing temperature and numbing the area. So especially for nervous patients, because the veins, the superficial veins are very delicate and especially easily damaged in Cushing's patients. Obviously maintain asepsis, but particularly these patients are prone to infection, so we need to be careful. And pre-oxygenation, yes, all the usual reasons, but the drugs can cause further desaturation and further muscle relaxation, giving respiratory depression. Cushing's patients have high levels of circulating steroids, so they are prone to corneal ulceration. So obviously lube the eyes up straight after induction and then repeat it as necessary. Now cornea should be lubricated every 90 minutes under anaesthesia, but these patients might require it more frequently. So I always tape the eyes of my patients shut, but that doesn't mean that they don't need lubricating. So lubricate them, I tape them shut, then repeat it as necessary. Now, if you're doing a dental and you've got lots of water and air and debris being thrown around, then that would be a repeat lubrication requirement. If you've got a bear hugger, which is brilliant, but if you've got the attachment near the head, you often get escape of hot air. So if the eyes are open, that will dry them out. Any brachycephalic patient, that their eyes are going to need lots more lubrication. And remember, you might need to IPPV these patients because they've got weak muscles, they're likely to have hypercapnia, the fact that they don't ventilate very well, and maybe they get alveolar collapse. So IPPV with a suitable circuit or pop them on a ventilator. So monitor all your usual things. Temperature, remember, if they're obese, their temperature might be high. On the other hand, if they've got thin skin and hair loss, the temperature might be low. Capnography is great. Your end tidal readings are likely to be high, but look for a rapid decrease, because if you get a rapid drop in CO2 or a rapid desaturation of your pulse SpO2, then that can indicate pulmonary thromboembolism. And blood pressure, yep, we might need to keep that higher, maybe 80 millimeters of mercury to avoid a decreased renal perfusion. If you happen to have an indwelling arterial line because you're doing invasive blood pressure measurements, then you can easily get arterial samples for blood gas analysis. So if you've got blood gas analysis, it's a very useful tool to have, especially if you suspect an embolism. If you haven't got an art line in, but you have got blood gas analysis, then you could do arterial puncture, but you need to immediately cap your needle with the rubber bung. So once you've got your arterial sample, pop that bung on that you get in the kit with your preheparinized syringes. Don't use the cap, apart from health and safety reasons. You don't want any air, room air getting in because that would contaminate the sample. So things that you're looking for if you suspect a PTE are hypoxemia and hypocapnia and respiratory alkalosis. So for recovery, we need to make sure that they don't have any compromise in ventilation, so supplemental oxygen and analgesia. Anticoagulant therapy is almost certainly going to be given preemptively. We need to make sure that we continue fluids until they're eating and drinking. We do want these patients up and at it quite quickly, so get them up and walking to get that blood flowing. That will further reduce the chance of embolism. Frequent short walks are best. Don't march them round the perimeter of your practice or wherever you exercise your dogs. Not long walks, but just frequent short walks. And we need to observe them really for 72 hours after anaesthesia for pulmonary thromboembolism. So moving on to the opposite end of the adrenal scale, and this is Addison's disease. Addison's called Addison's after the English physician, in the same way that Cushing's was called after Cushing's after he was an American physician. So Addison's disease is much more commonly seen in dogs, although it can occur in cats. It tends to be seen in young to middle-aged female dogs. It can be seen in any breed, but some of them have got a genetic predisposition. So including the Westie, Great Danes, Standard Poodles, and the Portuguese Water Dog. Now we're just going to concentrate today on primary adrenal typical form of Addison's, which is the most common type, and that tends to be an autoimmune disease. But there are others that you will read about. There's secondary pituitary form, where you get decreased ACTH, which leads to a reduction in cortisol and aldosterone. And then there is another form which is called the atypical, which means that all three layers of the adrenal cortex, or just the middle and inner layer, are dysfunctional. But we're just going to concentrate on the typical form. So this is caused by either a decreased cortisol, which is a glucocorticoid, or decreased aldosterone, which is the mineralocorticoid, or both. Aldosterone is responsible for taking back sodium ions and for getting rid of potassium ions in the distal convoluted tubule of the kidney. So if there's a deficiency of aldosterone, that will lead to electrolyte imbalances. So we see low sodium, which is hyponatremia, and high potassium, which is hyperkalemia. And if there's a glucocorticoid deficiency, then that probably won't cause any electrolyte imbalances, but it does blunt the stress response. So in Addison's disease, we see the classic, certainly in the typical form, we see the classic dark skin, and that is because of release of melanocyte stimulating hormone, MSH. This is the name given to a group of hormones which are produced in the skin and also by the pituitary gland and by the hypothalamus. Now, this dark skin is seen in the most common type, which is the primary adrenal insufficiency, but you won't see it in the secondary type. So again, we need to be careful with catheters and needles because these animals are prone to infection. The concerns with anaesthetising an Addison's patient mainly relate to fluid and electrolyte balance, so we get acid-base disturbances. Hypertension is likely because of the reduced aldosterone, and because they have renal insufficiency, we need to make sure that they've got adequate fluid replacement. We see bradycardia and bradyarrhythmias. These will occur because of the high potassium levels in the blood because of hyperkalemia. And slow conduction through the heart leads to ECG changes. So when you hook them up to an ECG, you're likely to see things which you wouldn't normally see. So of all the endocrine diseases, yes, I've spoken about pre-op sterilization, and it is important in all. It's imperative in Addison's disease. Electrolyte imbalances must be corrected, otherwise you're not going to get very far into your anaesthetic period without a crisis. So pre-op stabilization is mandatory, and anaesthesia should be delayed if necessary. Now, the type of fluid that we give is dictated according to results. And do we give normal saline, which we always used to give because they are hyponatremic, or do we give Hartmann's? Traditionally, normal saline was given to Addison's patients, but now lactated Ringer's solution, or Hartmann's, has shown to be more efficient at restoring acid-base balance. The theory behind this is that increasing sodium concentrations in patients which have had a chronic hyponatremia, so they've been used to operating with low sodium, can result in complications in the central nervous system. Also, normal saline is an acidifying fluid, and patients with Addison's disease have got a metabolic acidosis. So nowadays we'd just use a buffered isotonic crystalloid such as Hartmann's, which contains low potassium. The other thing is that they're almost certainly going to be on a hydrocortisone CRI, because they may never reach the stress response to surgery, and we don't want any post-op crisis because of low cortisol levels. You may need to spike the fluid. Glucose and insulin may be to drive the potassium back into the cells. So insulin stimulates the uptake of potassium by the cell membrane, and glucose just makes all that easier, and it also helps to maintain the blood glucose levels. Otherwise, insulin on its own might cause a hypoglycemia. But for stable patients, they just might need that balanced crystalloid, so compound sodium lactate, lactated Ringer's, Hartmann's, whatever you want to call it. Complications that we might see are bradycardia and bradyarrhythmias. So ECG monitoring is going to detect arrhythmias, but it will also pick up electrolyte imbalances. So the classic is peaked T waves that you see in hyperkalemia. Monitor blood pressure. We don't want hypertension to worsen. And I've put CVP with jugular catheter because these are generally high anaesthetic risks. So it's best gold standard really to place a central line if you have to anaesthetize a patient with Addison's disease. Monitor the central venous pressure and use it as a guide to the fluid therapy rate and the volume. Monitor glucose levels as well. We might see hyperglycemia. That occurs because cortisol opposes the action of insulin. So because they have a lack of cortisol, it means they're insulin sensitive and therefore they're prone to hyperglycemia. So check their blood glucose levels intraoperatively. So take your glucometer around with your anaesthetized patient. Yeah, they might become hypothermic. We need to avoid heat loss because of the consequences, your reduced metabolic rate and your low blood pressure. They might be hyperventilating, so you're almost certainly going to need to help them out breathing, use IPPV or pop them on a ventilator. And critical monitoring for these patients is going to extend well into the post-op periods. It's not the sort of patient you can just put back in its kennel, maybe just watch it for a few hours in recovery and then walk away. They need one-to-one for a long time. So the table here just shows the comparison between Addison's and Cushing's. So the differences are at the top in red and the similarities are at the bottom in blue. So you can see that with both of them, with corticosteroid, with Addison's it's low, but with Cushing's it's high. Weight loss in Addison's, but weight gain in Cushing's. Blood pressure is low in Addison's, but it's high with Cushing's. And the skin differences are that you get the hyperpigmented dark skin in Addison's, and the skin is thin, flaky, and bruises and tears in Cushing's. For both of them, the infection risk is high. The stress response is poor in Addison's, and it's abnormal in Cushing's. And for muscle dystrophy and fatigue, yep, they're both likely to suffer from that. So anaesthetizing patients with adrenal gland diseases is challenging, and certainly it's something that you need to understand the pathophysiology in order to be aware of the complications that you're likely to run into. Okay, so to finish off with, we're going to be looking at diabetes mellitus. So this is an a pancreatic endocrinopathy. It affects dogs and cats. We see two types, type 1 and type 2. Type 1 is where there's no insulin secretion, which is insulin-dependent type, and that's more common in dogs. And type 2, which is the non-insulin-dependent type, is where there's impaired insulin secretion, which is more common in cats. Both types can impact on anaesthesia, and often diabetic patients have got concurrent diseases that we need to take into consideration as well. So to look at some of the concerns, abnormal glucose metabolism will cause problems with lots of things, central, the autonomic, and the peripheral nervous system. We get problems with the kidneys, they're often hypertensive, and the central nervous system also knocks onto problems with the eyes. So this is an old dog here, so he's old, so he's got other considerations which need to be taken into account. He's only got one eye anyway, bless him, and in that one eye, he's got a cataract. High levels of carbon dioxide and glucose will affect cerebral autoregulation. Cerebral autoregulation is a compensatory mechanism whereby the blood vessels in the brain constrict and dilate to maintain a constant blood flow over a fairly wide range of perfusion pressures, but it is affected by carbon dioxide and glucose. And they're likely to have decreased cerebral perfusion, so we need to keep the mean arterial pressure higher than normal to maintain oxygen delivery to the brain. Glycemic control is really the main, really important consideration. One of the main challenges during anaesthesia is to maintain a constant acceptable blood glucose level. Now that's acceptable to the patient, not necessarily acceptable to the anaesthetist or to the veterinary surgeon or the nurse monitoring the anaesthetic. It's got to be what that patient's body is used to operating at. And the normal stress response means that we get increased blood glucose, and that can persist for some hours. So we need to minimize stress, both when the patient's awake and when it's anaesthetized, because stress can result from pain and from surgery itself. How long to withhold food? Well, there are several protocols that exist. You'll see that it's written up that the food should be withheld for 6 hours. In reality, that's not going to happen because normally we say withhold food from midnight the night before. If you're going to withhold food from 6 hours, we want to get these patients performed early in the day so that they can recover and get back to a normal routine. If you want to do it early in the day, it would mean the owner's going to be feeding the animal at about 2 o'clock in the morning, which is obviously non-realistic. But then if they give them their breakfast at 8 o'clock in the morning, you're not going to be doing it until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So an evening recovery, again, is not what we want. We need to measure the blood glucose, and how much insulin we give should depend on the results. And it's important to use the same glucometer for that patient to allow for individual variations in calibration. So this slide here shows one of the most sort of most current recommendations in the UK at present. So we're looking at the relationship between the pre-anaesthetic glucose levels and how much insulin is given. So if the blood glucose is less than 8 millimoles per litre, no insulin is given. If it's between 8 and 15, then we'd give a half dose. And if it's more than 15, a full dose. But this is only one protocol. There are others that exist. Another common one is that you give half dose insulin if the glucose is more than 10 millimoles per litre, and a quarter dose if it's less than 10. And then another one again might be you don't give it any insulin if it's less than 5 millimoles per litre, if it's between 5 and 11, a quarter dose, and if it's more than 11, a half dose. So there's no one size fits all here. The important thing is to go with the individual patient parameters. So our pre-op laboratory, we want to do hematology, PCV and total solids, total protein for hydration status, your biochemistry for your liver and kidney enzymes and your blood glucose, and urinalysis. We can detect glucose and protein, but not always ketones. The dipsticks that we use will only detect ketones in dogs. They detect acetoacetate, but not beta-hydroxybutyrate, which is the main ketone in cats. Acetoacetate is thought to be the predominant ketone in dogs, but beta-hydroxybutyrate is predominant in cats and in people. So in a cat, we can't always rely on dipstick analysis. So we need to gain IV access without stress. If they've got high blood pressure, then obviously the oxygen demands are going to be higher. So pre-oxygenation is going to be beneficial because it delays the onset of hypoxia and increases the safe apneic period. The safe apneic period is the time between an animal stopping breathing and the onset of hypoxemia and desaturation. So consider where it is you're going to induce anaesthesia. If it's in a communal area where people are likely to be walking through, might be a good idea to pop a few signs on the doors, especially if your patient is very nervous or anxious. So if you're anaesthetising a cat, you don't want it to be stressed out by somebody walking a dog through the prep room. On the other hand, if you're anaesthetising a dog, you don't want somebody carrying a cat in a basket if it's a terrier and it wants to eat the cat. So just try and keep the area quiet just while you induce anaesthesia. Diabetic patients have got increased risk of regurgitation. Hyperglycemia can damage the vagus nerve and also other nerves that control the movement of food through the stomach to the intestine. So we see delayed gastric emptying in diabetic patients, and that will increase the risk of regurgitation and aspiration. So your gold standard induction as normal would be induction and intubation with the animal in sternal recumbency, and keep that head raised until you've cuffed, you've inflated the cuff with air on your endotracheal tube. So when you've got your pharyngeal seal, then your regurgitation and aspiration risk reduce, and so you can lower the head. The type of fluid that we give is going to depend really on blood results. We need to give fluid before anaesthesia if they're PUPD to deal with any hypovolemia. And you might need to add something to the fluid, so maybe glucose if they're hypoglycemic, insulin if they're hyperglycemic, or glucose and insulin together for hyperkalemia. If their potassium levels are low, as in diabetic ketoacidosis, then you might want to add potassium. And if they have got DKA and they're acidotic, then traditionally we would have maybe added bicarbonate, but that's a little bit controversial now. So again, monitor everything that you would normally monitor, and you've taken your blood your glucometer with you to measure blood glucose levels about every 30 to 60 minutes. Hypoglycemia will affect cerebral function because the brain relies on glucose for energy. And hypoglycemia will reduce the MAC of your inhalant. So, in other words, it will make your isoflurane or your sevoflurane more potent, so you need less of it. So, if their blood glucose levels are low, then you need to, as well as addressing that by adding it to fluids, then you need to reduce your vaporizer concentration. We need to make sure we've got sort of blood glucose levels without any extremes or any swings. And we need to keep those glucose levels to those that the patient is used to. Blood pressure, we want to keep the mean arterial pressure higher. Impaired autoregulation means that we need to make sure oxygen continues to be delivered to the brain. And we also need to make sure we prevent hypothermia by taking suitable measures beforehand. We don't want a delayed recovery because the patient's got cold. We want them back and waking up normally and back to their normal regime. On other things to monitor are the depth of anaesthesia, because an inadequate depth will lead to the stress response, and also hyperthermia, hypercapnia and hypoxemia, they will also lead to the stress response. So as well as monitoring your depth and everything else, capnography and SpO2. So we need a quick recovery. We need them back to their normal routine as soon as possible. So monitor the blood glucose post-op as necessary. It may be that you do it every 1 to 4 hours, depending on the condition of the patient and the intra-op blood glucose levels. So if they've got something like insulinoma, or if they've got diabetic ketoacidosis, then you probably need to do it every hour for the first 4 hours, and then maybe every 2 to 4 hours. So feed them and then monitor their glucose after eating. You need to make sure that we've got adequate analgesia to make sure that the animal doesn't refuse to eat or stop eating because it's in pain. And then we need to get them back to their normal insulin regime really as soon as we can. So to sum up, any disturbance to normal homeostasis can result in complications under anaesthesia. And endocrinopathies have all got the potential for disrupting normal homeostasis. But if you've got a basic knowledge of the disease process, and if you're thoroughly prepared before anaesthetizing the patient, you can minimize the chances of complications and make anaesthesia for these patients with endocrine disease smooth and hopefully uneventful. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Denise for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.